The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. I hope this is giving you some sort of escape from the weirdness of everything. And for your pleasure, we're broadcasting from my shed and I've opened the window. So hopefully you'll be able to hear some bird song in the background, which might give you an extra lift this episode. So coming up on this week's show, we're going to be speaking to Chris Wanchek, formerly of NASA, about the things we'll need to do if we want to colonize the universe. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Laura Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is of course to do with COVID-19, Lara, and this is that AC/DC song might have given people a clue. This is the idea of using healthy people's blood to fix people who are unhealthy.
Yeah, absolutely. We have another couple of stories about the coronavirus today. And I think there's a lot of appetite for people to find out more about it because obviously it's so serious at the moment. And this is research that's coming out from New York at the moment. New York have a very, very serious outbreak. They seem to be almost the epicenter of the United States for COVID-19. And what they are trying to do now and what the Food and Drug Administration of the USA have just approved last Tuesday is to use serum, which is the blood from people without the red blood cells in it. So it's the blood without the cells, and the serum from people who had COVID-19 but have recovered, and they want to use that serum to treat people who have the disease. So it's almost a tale as old as time. This was first used in the 1890s to treat diphtheria and also tetanus in separate experiments. It's where you take antibodies from somebody who is better and you give them in a passive immunity to someone who is unwell. It was used also in the Ebola outbreak in 1995. They did it in 8 patients and only one of those 8 patients died, whereas Ebola normally has an 80 to 90% death rate. So it's, you know, potentially very, very effective. They did a very small trial over in China with COVID-19 where they treated 13 people who had very severe disease and they were in ICU. The good news is that in all of those people, the virus was cleared. But the bad news is that none of those people got better because they were already so far gone in the disease that the virus was no longer the problem. It was their own immune system that had, you know, which is basically the issue with people who are incredibly unwell with viruses. It's their own immune system that's gone wild and is killing them, essentially. But it is a very, very good stopgap idea. It's not going to be a long-term immunity. If you transfer immunity via this way, usually it only works for weeks to up to around about 3 months in the people who receive it. But it's a really good stopgap if you can use this to treat. So it's not their own antibodies. You're giving them antibodies, but you're not giving them the cells that produce the antibodies. So your own body clears out everything, usually within about 3 months in your blood. So if you have the cells in there that create the antibodies, you'll potentially be immune for life. In the case of COVID-19, we have absolutely no idea how long people will be immune for when they recover from it. The good news is that, yes, you will be immune. The bad news is it could be for only a year or it could be for 10 years. We don't know. I know. And the thing is, the coronavirus that we have now is very closely related to the common cold, which is also a coronavirus. And you're only immune from that for approximately 1 to 3 years after you catch it. But, you know, we could be immune for 10 years from just nobody knows that it hasn't been around long enough. And we won't know. I mean, MERS, which came out in the Middle East not too long ago, people believe to be immune for up to 10 years from that. So, you know, we could be immune for a long time.
If the cycle is every 3 years, we'll be cavemen and women in this space of a decade.
But see, the good news is even if you're not fully immune, if you can catch the disease again, your likelihood is you won't get anything like as severe an infection. Right. And also it'll be hugely staggered because some people could have immunity for a year, some for 2 years, some for 3 years. So, you know, our own natural immunity and this herd immunity is what we need. you know, to develop slowly over time without people dying in the interim. But this is a great stopgap, this providing blood from people who are well. But you need to pick the right people. You need people who have a lot of antibodies against the disease, and you need to be very careful who you give it to. I mean, I don't think it's going to work in end stage diseased people. I think it's better off people who are at risk but at an early stage. But we'll just see how it plays out. But really good stopgap and good potential for now.
So the ideal scenario for this particular treatment would be someone who is at high risk, who's been detected early as being positive.
Yeah, I think people who are high risk and early stage, or healthcare workers, you know, so you can give them this big load of antibodies that will make them protected for potentially up to 3 months, so that they continue working at the front line until treatments are more viable, or, you know, keep treating them until a vaccine is produced.
And so they can sleep with each other, which is, you know, I only watch a few medical
like in
dramas.
The on-call room in Grey's Anatomy.
Well, it just seems like doctors work really, really hard, and then they sleep with each other. And of course, they sleep with each other at the moment, not so easy. So it would be great.
Well, unless they're already immune, sure, who cares then, you know? But that's all about the antibody testing. So we'll talk about that maybe next week.
Could you imagine? Right, our second story, Shane, has nothing to do with coronavirus.
Yeah, physics is a great distraction at the moment. We kind of feel collectively useless as scientists right now. We're not able to kind of contribute in a positive way like immunologists. But there is some interesting stories that people might find amusing and interesting. This is a story from the US, where they have discovered what's called trans-Neptunian objects. So these are small planets beyond Neptune in our solar system. And they discovered more than 300 of them using a technique that wasn't designed to look for them. It's a great example of how curiosity and science can lead to new discovery, even though it wasn't part of the original grant application. So the array, the two telescopes were set up to look for dark energy. And so using data from the two telescopes, as scientists in the US started looking at unusual parts of the sky, places that were very, very faint, as in there was something very faint there, but they were able to kind of remove objects that they knew were stars or galaxy or supernovae. And so they started out with 22 million unknown objects in the southern sky, and using an incredible incredible feat of computer science, they were able to whittle that down to 400 good candidates from the 22 million objects. And so, just to give listeners a sense, that wouldn't be done kind of one by one with somebody kind of looking at it and making a yes or no answer. They would have written algorithms that would look for it. And so they whittled it down to 400 good candidates. And within that, then, taking a closer look with telescopes, they discovered 316 real trans-Neptunian objects.
Now, the most famous one. You use the term planets, right? And when you say planets, I start thinking about the mnemonic that people are going to have to learn to add an extra 300 planets. How do they compare to the ones that we already have?
Well, we've discounted Pluto as a planet. I think the only good reason for putting Pluto into the list is that kind of people like it being there. So we have the mnemonic of what was the one I learned? My very educated mother just showed us nine planets, and that was the way of learning your planets from Mercury out to Pluto.
Yeah.
But we only consider the first eight planets real planets. Beyond that, then, we call them trans-Neptunian objects, or minor planets. And so these are tiny objects, rocky objects that are out in the edges of the solar system. So Pluto is 40 times further from the sun than we are. And this whole new range of objects is between 30 times and 90 times further out from the sun than we are.
But surely what matters is not how far away they are. If they're in the solar system and they are planet sized, then isn't it a bit,
well,
I mean, it smells of a cover up if we're not going to include 300 new planets.
I didn't think you were going to go down that route, but these are rocky objects that, suppose, when is it a planet and when is it not? One good kind of category that I think of is the so-called Pedato radius, which is if you have a rock out in the outer solar system, once it gets to a certain size, the force of gravity for the massive object is going to start to deform it so that it reshapes into a spherical object as opposed to some sort of weird Duck. Lumpy data-like thing.
It's amazing that you haven't yet given me the comparison between Pluto and the other planets, and it sounds like you're trying to cover something up. Are these planets the same size as Pluto or not?
No, they'd be smaller than Pluto.
Much smaller?
And the paper didn't give a huge amount of detail because they basically said that whilst they're able to see or sort of detect these objects, they're very faint. So they're not able to say a huge amount about them just yet.
Interesting. okay. Thanks for that, Shane. Our second COVID story, Lara, has about a vaccine. A piece in the Irish Times says testing for a vaccine is imminent. And only last week we were talking about 18 months. So what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. They've made me sound like a liar, but I promise I'm not. But no, you're right. There is an article in the Irish Times that just came out, and it's talking about a vaccine that they've come up with in the Jenner Institute over in Oxford University. So it's a new vaccine that they've come up with. And it's just important to note that about 35 to 40 different companies around the world are working on a vaccine at the moment. And actually on the 16th of March, the very first person over in the United States was injected with a potential vaccine in a phase one trial. I think what's really important about this article in the Irish Times is that people don't buy into it too quickly. I don't mean to sound very negative about it all, but I firmly stand by my belief that the fastest a vaccine will be available for this disease is 12 months. And I really think 18 months is the most realistic. I really think winter 2021 is when we might have a vaccine. If we're lucky, vaccines normally take 10 years to come through.
So what are they testing then?
So what they're doing is they're using a kind of tried and tested type of vaccine called an adenovirus vaccine vector. And it's been used in about 10 different vaccines for different diseases in the past. So they take a different virus and they package the virus that you want to be vaccinated against inside this virus, and they inject it into people. And it works like any vaccine does. It causes your immune system to react quite aggressively to an antigen, which is a part of the vaccine, a part of the virus. And then in the future, you should largely be immune to this virus. So it's the same notion. And because it's a tried and tested vaccine in the past, this adenovirus vaccine, they're hoping that they can rush it through quickly. If you think about it logically, the flu vaccine is rushed through very quickly every year. Flu mutates, and that's the bad thing about flu. And that's why we need vaccines every year. So it is possible to get a vaccine through if it's based on a pre-existing vaccine. But I still don't think it's going to be that rapid. It still has to do all the three phases. The worst thing they could possibly do is bring out a vaccine that's not ready, that causes disease or that causes harm to people, and then everybody loses trust. And they won't. That's not going to happen. Nobody's going to be that irresponsible. I mean, maybe Trump would if he had his way, but at least the FDA is over in America to stop him. But
I think you just grab it out of the scientist's hands and glug it down in front of the national press.
He probably would.
I'm cured.
He probably would. Yeah, I'm better.
And finally, Shane, probably something we already knew already, but Siri is racist.
Yeah, not just Siri, but Alexa. Basically, all of the voice recognition software from Amazon, from Apple, from Google, IBM and Microsoft is biased. Who would have thought it? I think Irish people would know that anyway, basically, if you've ever kind of asked Siri a question or Alexa a question, a lot of the time they really can't handle our Hiberno English. But this is a study from the United States that looked at the ability of these softwares to understand white people and to understand black people. And they got the speech wrong for white people in 19% of the cases, and they got the speech wrong for black people in 35% of the cases. And this would have been done in a systematic way by researchers. Like, it really is awful. And to think that these companies that are worth like an absolute fortune are not using smarter AI systems to teach the AI systems about bias.
Yeah, I think, you know, probably there is a lot of pressure on these product teams to get what they need out. And so the amount of testing they do in the field, it clearly isn't strong enough. I mean, we know that there's lots of issues when it comes to race. I mean, even some hand dryers don't work if the person wanting to dry their hands isn't white. The way I get around the problem with the Hiberno accent is I affect a typical American accent, kind of like John Wayne, and it works every time. Well, I was trying to think of like a stereotypical.
Does that work for the racist
hand dryers as well? I was just thinking of like what's a stereotypical American, you know, and that was, so I'm always, it's kind of mostly Western dialect, you know.
Is this it now?
Cowboy talk. No.
This is like chicken and egg, Jonathan. Like if we all start doing this as these technologies become more like everywhere in our world, will we all just have the same mid-Atlantic accent?
Well, I guess that's a puzzler I ain't going to solve today.
Oh, God.
That was good, wasn't it?
I prefer a racist hand dryer, to be honest.
Okay. All right. Let's wrap this up. Dr. Lara Duggan, Dr. Shane Birkin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Now, it may surprise some of you to know that I'm not really a huge fan of sci-fi, to be honest. I know. I'm sure you're all very disappointed in me. I know my producer, Aidan, is. But some of it is just a bit, I suppose, aspirational. I mean, even the granddaddy of them all, Star Trek, it just doesn't make a huge amount of sense to me. I just don't see humans ever wanting to go and live in the other parts of the universe because they're just so inhospitable. But if we were to ever venture out of this atmosphere, what challenges are in our way and what innovations have we thought of to try and get around them? Well, Christopher Wanchek is author of Spacefarers, How Humans Will Settle the Moon, Mars and Beyond. He joins me now. Chris, do you believe that will happen, that we will settle Mars and beyond?
It will happen. It will definitely happen. The settlement of Mars depends on, I think, one key factor that not that many people are talking about, and that's gravity. You can protect yourself against the radiation, the lack of pressure on Mars, and all these other problems, but you can't change the gravity. And the gravity is 39% that of Earth. Is that enough to live for the long term? Maybe. Is it enough to raise children? That's an open-ended question there. If it's not, then we can't settle there.
Yeah, the question of children obviously is an issue for anything beyond staying there and coming back. What do we know about the effect of even Mars's gravity on humans?
We know absolutely nothing. That's what's remarkable and frustrating. We have two data points. We know what it's like on Earth, 1G, conveniently one, it's one, okay, and zero gravity, 0G. We know that. They're the only two data points. Put that on a graph. There's no way to connect those two dots. Is it a linear connection between 0 and 1? Is it kind of concave where you need a lot of gravity, like upwards of 90% to be healthy? Or do you need just a little bit, maybe like 10% gravity? Maybe that's enough to be healthy. We have no idea how they connect.
So we don't know what a family or reproduction or what any of that looks like in zero gravity, and less so what a bit of gravity might look like, which is what they have on Mars. How do we go about testing that? We have to get to Mars. Is there no way of recreating what 0.38 Gs is like?
There's essentially the main way to do it is to create the so-called artificial gravity through centrifugal force. And that's kind of a rotating sphere. On a trip to Mars, this could be done via the spacecraft attached by tether to a distant counterweight and have the spacecraft tumble over the counterweight over and over again on the way to Mars and have a rotation of about one or two times per minute all the way to Mars. That could produce, depending on the length of the tether, a 30% gravity or a 50% gravity, whatever you want to set it at. So that's a somewhat straightforward way to climatize yourself, if you will, to the gravity of Mars.
Are NASA, as far as you know, looking at testing a centrifugal type gravity simulation spacecraft?
No, they are not, to the frustration of me and many others. They are geared on minimizing the effects of zero gravity, as bizarre as that sounds. They are trying to find ways through exercise regime and and medicines to minimize the bone loss on a 6 month or to 6 months to 9 month journey to Mars. That's their focus, and not on just providing the artificial gravity.
Did the Japanese do a test on these centrifugal devices?
Yes, they had a test in mind that was quite bold early on in the ISS lifespan, but NASA nixed it because they felt that it would shake up the ISS too much. So they scaled down their experiment on their module within the ISS, and in it it was small, and they spun around mice essentially. The mice may have gotten dizzy because it was a small kind of container. And if you want to create artificial gravity without creating the nausea of spinning around and around like a amusement park ride, it has to be big. But in this small experiment, they had mice who experienced the essentially Earth-like gravity in space, and they had absolutely no problems with bone loss or some of the other symptoms you see with zero gravity.
So
absolutely none. So you know it works.
Yeah, I suppose varying levels of gravity, the lack of atmosphere allows for some innovative ideas. And one of my favorite ones from the book is how we might travel outside of our solar system. And it's an ingenious idea to hollow out an asteroid. Why would we want to do that?
Yes, that was inspired by the great Freeman Dyson, who just died about 2 weeks ago now, physicist. So the issue of traveling in interstellar space is that you need to move rather fast, but the faster you go, the more dangerous it is. It's like insects or flies on your windshield as you're going down a highway at great speeds. So there are bits of particles all through the universe, and as you plow through that, those particles are going to go smashing right through your windshield. So it's actually somewhat impossible to travel at high speeds through space because your spacecraft will be eaten up by these little particles crashing through the windshield and kill you. So the idea of an asteroid is that's your protection. If you're inside the asteroid, all that crust serves as protection. And theoretically, you know, there's lots of asteroids out there. And if you had one that was, say, 100 meters in diameter, roughly the size of a sports stadium, okay, you could bore inside there and create kind of a cylinder, a rotating cylinder, to create your artificial gravity and your own little world inside this asteroid. And then, you know, again, theoretically, it's all feasible. As you're whipping around the sun, if you give it a kick in the right direction, you could fly off at perhaps upwards of 10% light speed to a distant solar system. What's also nice about the asteroid idea is that everything you need to live are in most of these asteroids. A lot of them are about 10% water. They have all the minerals and nutrients you would need to support life there. In fact, a lot of what's on Earth came from asteroids crashing down billions of years ago.
In the book, you don't just talk about Mars. You talk about other planets. And one of the craziest of them all is the idea that we could survive on Mercury. I really didn't think that was possible. How does that work?
Yeah, Mercury is surprisingly habitable. What's really fascinating about Mercury is it's pretty small. It's about the size of the moon, but it's so dense with metal that it's actually as heavy as Mars and has the same level of gravity, about 38% that of Earth. So in that respect, it's the same as Mars. But and of course, you know, Mercury is the closest to the sun. And you would think it's the hottest thing in the solar system, but it isn't. Venus is hotter. And Mercury doesn't have an atmosphere like Venus does. So because it doesn't have an atmosphere, it can't circulate the heat. That means when the sun is shining on it during the day, it is scorching, of course, over 400 degrees Celsius. But at night, it gets down to a negative 170 degrees Celsius. So that is one of the most coldest places in the solar system at that point.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure out where we're supposed to live, Chris.
Oh, Oh, I see. So what's nice about Mercury is during the dawn and the dusk, the temperature is just right. Before it gets too hot, before it gets too cold. So if you're living in that dawn and dusk area, you're good to go. And you could stay in that dawn and dusk area for an interesting reason. Mercury spins so slowly that the day is really, it's like 176 Earth days. And with that rotation being so slow, if you're on a train or even any type of vehicle, even walking at 3 kilometers per hour westward, if you keep on moving that, you will stay in that perpetual area of dawn or dusk or wherever you are. You can follow the sunrise, follow the sunset, in other words. And so you could live on these caravans, on these that are just going around the middle part of Mercury.
That is
what you would do, I don't
idea.
Know, but you can mine, you know, or you can look for things. I don't know what you would do exactly, but
you'd
it's
have
feasible
to
do that. Yeah, you got to move or you're toast.
Yeah,
or,
that is
or
a,
ice.
That is a really interesting idea that you just stay in that Goldilocks zone between heat and cold. What about Venus then? Is Venus is that a complete write-off?
Yeah, Venus is also surprisingly habitable. In many ways, people argue more habitable than Mars. You know, Venus has that hellish heat of, 450 degrees Celsius all the time, day and night. It doesn't change. But if you're high up in the atmosphere of Venus, 50 kilometers up, well, then you have a balmy temperature of only 50 degrees Celsius. Hot, but manageable. And because it's about the same size as the Earth, the gravity is almost the same. So that's about 90% that of Earth, 9G, 0.9G.
Wow.
So you got that going for you. The air pressure is perfect as well. It's about the same type of air pressure on Earth when you're way up there. On the surface, it's 92 times that of Earth. You know, that'll crush you like a tin can. But up in the atmosphere, in a balloon, if you have these floating balloon cities, you could essentially be levitating above Venus. You could even be outside on a platform as long as you have some type of breathing apparatus, because there'd be no oxygen up there. But you could essentially be floating around above Venus in a comfortable temperature range, relatively, but ideal pressure and gravity. You could even maybe go skydiving as long as you don't go too low.
I love the idea of that. I'm wondering how practical it would be in reality. But let's finish with Titan, because Titan, Saturn's moon, has an average temperature of 179 degrees. But listening to you, it sounds like that is no big deal.
Oh, yeah. What, you know, in my mind, you know, cold is cold, airless is airless. So if it's going to be below Earth range type coldness, then Mars, whether you're on Mars or Pluto or anywhere, it really doesn't matter. So yeah, you could live on Titan in very creative ways. Now, of course, Titan is one of the moons of Saturn. Yeah, Saturn has 60 plus moons. It's pretty far. You know, it's going to take you about 3 years to get there. It takes an hour to 90 minutes just for radio waves or light to reach there. So the messaging would take a while. But there are all these interesting things about Titan, mainly because it has an atmosphere, one of the only places in the solar system other than Earth with a significant atmosphere. That atmosphere is slightly heavier than Earth, so it's about 1.5 that of Earth's atmosphere. So you could comfortably live there on the surface without a bulky pressurized suit. The other funky thing about Titan is that its gravity is somewhat low, about 14% that of Earth. So the combination of those two, an atmosphere and low gravity, means essentially you could fly on Titan. If you had these, you know, you strap on some artificial wings, you would be able to fly. You'd have a flycicle, like a bicycle that could fly. You could fly around. That would probably be the best way to move around on Titan, is by flying.
A flycicle is a word I have not
flycicle.
Heard before.
Yeah, no, I think I'm coining that. I looked it up. Nothing. I think that's mine for now. And you also might know Titan is a candidate for a possible place where life could be, because it's the only place known in the solar system with a a liquid cycle of clouds and rain and rivers and lakes. But I misspoke. That liquid is not water. It's methane and ethane, these hydrocarbons, liquid. It's so cold that these gases on Earth are actually in a liquid phase on Titan. But they move around from clouds to rain to rivers to lakes, just like water does on Earth. So could any type of creature be living in that? There's these massive lakes, like Lake Kraken, which is 400,000 kilometers squared, which I calculated to be almost twice the size of the entire UK. So there's these vast oceans or lakes of liquid hydrocarbons. And scientists are speculating whether there could be actual creatures living in there that would be able to utilize the types of materials that are on Titan, namely carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen, to form some type of membrane. It all seems to be feasible in a theoretical kind of way that you could have membranes that can survive at that temperature on Titan.
Well, the way humankind is going at the moment, we may have lots of Earth to go around, or we may find Mars is a much more pleasant prospect than staying here. So who knows? But for the moment, Chris Wanchek, author of Spacefarers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now it's time to look back at some of your emails, texts, and tweets from last week's show, when we were talking to Justin Schmidt about the, I guess it was a 101 in insect physiology. Sean in Tralee says, ask your guest what the bullet ant sting was like. Well, we actually interviewed Justin a few years ago, and he basically categorized the pain of 100 different animals in a pain chart. That episode is actually going to appear in the Future Proof Gold feed. So if you're a podcast listener, which I hope you are, Sean, you'll be able to listen back and find out. Joe Cully said, really enjoyed that. I was fascinated how the trachea break down to reach every individual cell. It's as if every bit of the creature is open to the elements. Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. It did feel like I was in biology class, but it was a lot of stuff that I didn't know, or at least don't remember. I pretty much anything before I was 17, I've forgotten. In news, we talked about climate change. Jerry says the people most responsible for climate change are the middle class, who gallivant needlessly around the globe on holidays and junkets. Jerry, that's a lie. We've been told. I mean, obviously, air travel is a big thing, but it's major corporations that are responsible. It's government inaction. It's failure to legislate. Personal action, even when it comes to flights, doesn't really come close to wide-scale destruction of habitats, of emissions, burning fossil fuels, and so on. Although you're right, we probably do need to think a lot about flight, and certainly now is the time to think, as we are forced to, about how we can do things that used to require travel and now we might be able to do remotely. So hopefully a lot of companies will look at how productive these meetings that people are having virtually are, and hopefully they'll reduce quite a lot of the flights that people tended to do a one-to-one or a one-to-three meeting. It doesn't seem to make sense to me. I know a lot of people fly for that reason, but I think the people most responsible are the people in power, the 1%, and the government, who can enact change if they're not too beholden to business. We were talking about COVID-19, of course, and loads of messages on that. Mary from Dublin says, lads, keep your distance. You're a fool if you don't. Another says, my darling cat developed a barking cough this morning. Seems to have gone now, but in the danger of sounding paranoid, I have to admit I was a little afraid. Look, fear comes in many forms at the moment. I totally get that. And this is possible treatment from India can't be trusted, but Bojo's NHS more trusted. I don't know if they're, we were talking about an Indian apparent cure for coronavirus, and how Dr. Laura Dungan, an immunologist herself and medical doctor, said, look, there's not enough scientific data. This wasn't a science study. We can't really say anything from this. I'm not sure whether your text is being sarcastic about the NHS, but I suppose it depends on what's being claimed. Every claim is as valid as the evidence that's provided to support it. Mark in Cork says bleach is the most effective domestic product to kill viruses on surface tops. Okay. There are other ones as well, I suppose. If it says, you know, that there, I don't particularly think I'd like my whole kitchen to smell of bleach, but whatever floats your boat. Louise said, a global health expert that advises WHO gave a TED talk saying that global warming is, of course, related to the spread of and rise of viruses, and more will happen. It's time to wake up on climate change. They're not separate entities, that's for sure, when we think about climate change and what's happening at the moment. The change of temperature will have an effect on the ability to reproduce. The amount we're traveling will have an effect on the ability of viruses to travel. There's no question global warming and pandemics are in some way related, Louise. And another says, Jonathan, the virus originated from these horrible wet markets that the Chinese indulge themselves in, disease-ravaged markets. That practice has to be stopped, the consumption of local wildlife. Well, look, it's easy for us to trample in and say your cultural practices are not okay. I think it is a tricky one. Number one, you don't know that this is where the virus comes from. We do know it's a natural origin. We don't know if it's come from a food market. We simply don't know how it did jump from one species to another. It may never be possible to find out. But I suppose your question is, Chinese people shouldn't be allowed to eat these things. Well, I think every culture has its red lines in the sand. And to me, obviously, as a Westerner, it seems like there are a few lines that Chinese cuisine doesn't cross. But the question is sustainability. Would you prefer that they imported avocados from Israel, for example? It comes down to sustainability, cultural practices, and also, you know, is it something that people want to do? Like, if there is a large population of native bats that are delicious and in plentiful supply and are a good source of protein and nutrition, who am I to say that Chinese people should not eat them? If they do, it's not, I don't think we can tell people what to do. But I suppose hygiene and safety, I'm all for that. Sustainability, I'm all for that. But and if this wildlife is not sustainable, or it's precious, or it's protected, that to me obviously is a huge problem. But I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what species of bat they may or may not eat in China. Maybe no one eats bats. Another says, hi guys, love the show. We all listen every Saturday with the kids. You're the Irish Monkey Cage. Well, it's a huge compliment. Thank you very much for that. I believe the current situation is a low-level test run, probably 10% of the disruption compared to what geopolitical, social, economic, and natural difficulties are ahead due to climate change. Look, people have died. People have become very sick. So it's hard to say, oh, there's a positive to come out of this without sounding completely inhumane. But hopefully this shock to our system will teach us something about interdependence, working together, the need to think about how we consume, travel and work, and the priorities that we really should have in life. They go on to say, it will hopefully change perception as to priorities, good health, good food, helping others, and a connected society as opposed to entitlement, blaming others, silo of thought and obsessions with marketing, money, and the desire to be better than others. Keep up the inspirations, from Benny. And he says, we're heading into the garden to build a bridge. Is that a metaphorical bridge, Benny, or will you be able to actually walk over it? Thanks very much for your text. And that's it from your texts and tweets from this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing this week, Simon Keane, who was researching, and on sound, Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. That gold episode, as I say, will be the interview with Justin Schmidt. In the meantime, stay curious. We'll see you next week.